We are talking with Petter Amundsen. Welcome back, and thank you for joining us here in the second hour. We are talking about Shakespeare, the hidden truth, and the clues that Petter discovered using steganography in the works of Shakespeare's that led us to the alleged treasure, or whatever it actually is, at Oak Island. And when we left off, Petter, in the first hour, we basically were rushing through some of the most interesting parts and items, and we need to spend some more time talking about this, and I want to ask you more about the findings, of course, and the speculations of what it is that you've actually been looking for. But let us talk a bit first about the material that led you to the discovery again. I wanted to ask you more about who do you think that the cipher was designed for, and why whoever actually did it then, did they put it in such an open way for anybody to discover it, basically?
Well, I think that it was meant to be discovered, but not by anyone. Because I think that the originators of this, if we accept that there is something, just for the argument, I think the originators would like to know that the person or persons who spotted this at a later stage would have undergone certain training that made them more likely to behave responsibly if they should be the finders. And this is where Freemasonry enters the picture, because I see Freemasonry as a key here, because the Masonic training was what made the difference between nothing and all in my own search. Because if I didn't have had my Masonic training, I wouldn't have understood anything of what was going on here. And the Masonic Lodge not only teaches you about symbols, it also tries to teach you something about ethics and moral. So perhaps they were considering the idea that those who would have the Masonic training needed to find the treasure map, they would also have a basic training in ethics and morals. So the way I see it is that the treasure map is put in a big book that was very valuable and was probably treasured by their owners, and they could allow themselves to print maybe 800 copies of this treasure map, because they know that it will be impossible to find the secret unless you have this special training that the lodge provides. And they sent the treasure map in one direction as a book, and or actually two books, and the toolbox for ripping this apart was launched in another direction. And maybe these two items would come together sometime in the future. And at least this is a description of my own experience with this, because I felt that it came together, and it took 400 years for that to happen. But if they who did this thought it would take so long time, it's impossible to speculate. Maybe sure, they were thinking that 100 years perhaps, I don't know.
Now, there is a couple of other hints here as well then. I mean, are you saying that it was designed for Freemasons to discover? I mean, if we look at some of the people that have actually been involved in the digs, at least around the money pit, and I want to ask more about that specifically later, but we have people like, FDR, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, showing up, I think at the age of 27, 1909. This is basically 2 years before he actually was initiated. He was, I think, 32nd or 33rd degree of the Scottish Rite. So why haven't other Masons discovered what you've discovered before you, or have they?
Well, some people say that if it is a Masonic treasure, it may already have been discovered and it may have been moved. Some say it could have been moved to Washington. But I'm not that certain. And we also know that as you say, FDR was one of the treasure seekers, but there have been many, many Masons over the centuries who have been looking for this treasure. Perhaps it's an inclination that those people who are fascinated by being a Freemason will also be fascinated by a treasure hunt. Perhaps it's just a character trait, but yeah, well, it's hard to say if there really is a connection there, but I prefer to think of the treasure as being not yet found.
Yeah.
At least we know that if it had been removed, they were very careful with leaving no trace of that operation. But then it would be very safe if you have a treasure location and you find the treasure, and without making anyone know that you really found it, you just leave it just as it were, and then you move the treasure to another place, then of course it's impossible to know what happened to it, unless you leave new markers at a new spot. But then why would you care to move it in the first place if you are the kind of person who wants to leave traces of it? Because I think it they really wanted to leave a trace. It should be possible, at least in theory, to find it. We also know that there are Masonic symbols related to story as it has been handed down with the putti and the clay, etc. In some Masonic lodges, we see that these are symbols used. And also the degree that we do not have in Scandinavia, but there is this this top degree that involves looking for a treasure, where people are being hoisted down into a vault and then discovering something. And there is a parallel here. So some people have said that it's just a Masonic ruse, this, so it's not a real treasure, but some Masonic influence. But again, I'm just speculating.
Like it would be an ongoing kind of an initiation of sorts, but like an ongoing game, I guess. Is that what you're alluding to?
Maybe. I'm not alluding to it. I'm just quoting other people.
Sure.
I don't think that... this is what's really going on. But why it has not been discovered earlier? I think that you would need to be a true expert in Shakespeare. I am not, but I have other areas where I have bits of information, but I do have the internet. So when you have the internet and you can access all of Shakespeare in milliseconds to search for words, you get a wonderful advantage. So this has been my advantage here. So this is one of the reasons that I think it's very difficult for someone to discover this before you have the internet as a tool.
To coalesce all the information and look at all the different angles to it. Now, let me ask you this. Why did they place it at Oak Island? Why in the New World at all, I guess, the New World? And were they actually trying to hide it from someone specific?
The last part of that question is impossible to give a good answer to. But the first, at least I have my theory. Why Oak Island? And we are in Nova Scotia. That is New Scotland.
Yeah.
This is a part of the world that suddenly has become in the British domain. They got it from the French. And it is a part of the world that is being colonized. And this means that it is not very developed. It's desolate in a way, but it is still important. And we know that some people saw America as the new land of milk and honey, the new coveted land, and they had all kinds of hopes for beautiful development in
Bacon, the new Atlantis, right?
Yes, for instance. And he was also a part of a group who owned that part of America. And in 1910, there is this famous stamp, postage stamp, that was made in Newfoundland with a picture of Francis Bacon. And he is our founder, the guiding spirit in the foundation of Newfoundland. So he was involved with business and colonization in that part of the world. But most of all, I think it is the perfect position of Nova Scotia in relationship with the stars, because there is it's a stellar treasure map we are talking about here. Constellations are being used to tell about this treasure. And there is a spot in the sky that for a Mason will unite the old covenant with the new. The new covenant is Christianity, and the old is the old pact that the Jewish people made with Yahweh. And if you are a Mason, you will see that you move seven steps up a symbol that is the square and compasses, the jewel of the Masons. And then you are at the pinnacle, you are at the top where the Christian cross in the sky, the Northern Cross, also called the Swan or Cygnus in Latin. The top star is Deneb. So this top of the cross is united with the Jewish temple Freemason side of the story. And if you project that star called Deneb down onto the earth, then you are at Nova Scotia. And the way you can do this is that you have the longitude and the latitude on both the earthly globe and also the celestial globe. And when you superimpose Deneb onto the terrestrial, the earth globe, then you will see that it is at Nova Scotia, almost at Mahoney Bay. You just need to align the zero meridians so that you do not use the modern zero meridian that is passing through Greenwich, but use the old one that was touching the westernmost of the Canary Islands. So that makes Nova Scotia a wonderful candidate. And then why an island? Of course, they could have put it inland, but it would be safer on an island. And the tempest that play by William Shakespeare is so important here, and it takes place on an island, and there is this parallel. And also you mentioned the New Atlantis, which also is on an island, so this island idea is very strong here. And then why in Mahoney Bay? Well, maybe they just found a perfect candidate that had the right kind of soil, the right kind of swamp to hide something in. Again, speculation.
Sure. Yeah. You have the Cygnus, right? The swan. The idea of even a black swan, but also the carrier of life. There's Cygnus pops up in a lot of astrotheological circles, if you will, as a carrier of something new, you know, life in that regard. So it's a lot of interesting symbolism there. But let's talk a little bit more about the lamp now as well. I mean, how much have you looked into, example, for the original discovery, I guess, back in 1695 by the young teenager Daniel McGuinness, was it? I think he saw allegedly some lights and everything else. What kind of lamp are we talking about here? Or is this a Judaic mythology? Is this an older item that they, picked up in many of their backs and forth that they had throughout their history. What are we talking about here?
Yes, the Daniel McGuinness story with the light that some people saw lights out on the island. I do not connect this with the nature of the treasure, which is, of course, the menorah, the Jewish lamp that used to be lit in the temple that was destroyed by the Romans in year 70, that Titus and his troops went crashing through Jerusalem, and they brought the lamp and a few other items back to Rome and paraded it through the streets of Rome up the Via Sacra up to the Jupiter temple, where Titus's father Vespasian, he said that now we have peace in our realm, we will now create a new temple, a temple of peace, so that we can celebrate this peace, and it will be like a museum, and the cornerstone in this museum will be the Jewish vessels, the menorah and the silver trumpets and the showing bread table that his son had looted the year before. So this is it's a prototype for a museum, and the menorah and the other items were stored there for 400 years. And then Rome was attacked by the Vandals, and they took the spoils to Carthage, and it remained there for about 70 years. And then the guys from Constantinople took Carthage and brought the vessels to Constantinople, to Byzantium. And some Christian there said to the king that it's a bad omen to have these items. We should return them to Jerusalem. And this is the last thing we hear about these sacred vessels. So let's assume that they were brought to Jerusalem, and where in Jerusalem? Of course, this is an open question. But I know that if I had the task, if it was on my shoulders to find a good place for the return of these items, I would go to the original spot, which is the Temple Mount. And of course, Titus had ruined the temple, and this is before the mosque was erected there. So we know that there are cellars, stables, etc., in the foundations of the temple. So maybe they went down into ruins and found a suitable spot and put it there and covered it up and went back to Byzantium. And then centuries pass, and then some knights come along. We have 9 knights that showed up in Jerusalem around 1120, and they were digging for 8 years in the ruins, we hear. This is what history tells us. Mm-hmm. And who knows what they may have found. So I theorize that they discovered what was put there by the Byzantinians. And
it's amazing that they voluntarily did that, though, considering potentially if it was an important item, it might have been made of gold or something like that, right? And it's amazing did they bring some kind of curse with it? Is that what you're kind of saying?
No, I'm not implying this. I'm just saying that they may have discovered this and brought it back to Europe. And let's say they are successful in finding the menorah. They have most of what you need to furnish a temple. And then they hear about the Ethiopian link to the Ark of the Covenant. Mm-hmm. Because in Aksum, there is a tradition that they have the Ark of the Covenant, and it is still there, and it's being paraded in the streets once a year on the day of Epiphany. And We hear that back in the 13th century, some Europeans were befriending the king there and helping him with some military projects, and they evolve into having the privilege of parading the ark in the streets on the day of Epiphany. And who knows if they snatched it, because the reason I say this is that there is at least one account that says that the Ark of Aksum is not anymore the original. It was destroyed, the original was destroyed. And we also know that the year before the Templars were crushed by the Pope and the French king. This happened in 1307, but in 1306, for the first time, an Ethiopian group was visiting the Pope, and he was then staying in Avignon. And we don't know what their business was, but maybe they were complaining that these knights had stolen their ark. And this would give the Pope good reason to attack the Templars, because if they had the Ark, then that would be something to have. At least there are rumors today that the Vatican has at least the menorah. I don't think that is the case, but we like to think that the Roman Church is greedy. They want to have all the treasures for themselves. But let's say that it is not just the money situation that the French king had, because he was owing lots of money to the Templars. But the Pope wanted the Ark and perhaps some other items that he had heard rumors of that the Templars may possess. So in 1307, on October the 13th, of course, a Friday the 13th, which is allegedly the origin of Friday the 13th as a bad omen, bad day, they attacked them overnight. But we know the story that they fled. They had perhaps as much as 18 ships going out from La Rochelle, and who knows where they went. Most stories include Scotland as one likely refuge for the Templars. Some say Portugal, and some say they went to America. But Scotland is at least not unlikely, because we find Templar remains up there, symbols and
The
wrists.
Sinclairs and all that, yeah.
Yes, and we have the Battle of Bannockburn, where there is a tradition that suddenly men in white cloaks with red crosses on arrives, and that changes everything. So, but if this really happened, or if it is just a legend, we can't know. But we know that masonry includes something that is very Templar-like, and it happens in Britain. And there is a Scottish masonry, and lots of this is obscured. But so this is basically my theory, that Titus took the menorah, brought it to Europe, and then it ended up in Scotland, and it was owned or controlled by those who were in charge of developing Freemasonry.
Is that why you have the Scottish Rite, for example, over in the US?
Yes, the Scottish Rite is because of the Scottish influence in Freemason on Freemasonry. But for maybe they had reason to find a safer place for it, or even they may have speculated that they would use this new temple with these relics that they were bringing over as a foundation stone for the new wonderful world that they were erecting in the Western Hemisphere. So I think it's it's a beautiful idea that they make this new temple, which is not a temple in the normal sense of the word, where you see a building with columns, etc., but it is the templum in the original sense, which is just the geometric layout on the ground. And in Rome, it was the augurs, the soothsayers, who had this job to create the templum, which is just something that happens on the ground. And the idea was to unite heaven and earth. And later, some people were building an edifice, a building, edificium in Latin, on top of that. So my new temple is just a geometric layout. And on Oak Island, you have such a geometric layout. You have something that looks like the swan, the cygnus in the sky. And you also have a cross. And that cross also can be made into a Jewish tree of life. So you combine the old covenant with a new covenant, Judaism with Christianity, and you also bring in the swan idea here, and then you just have to calculate the tree of life, and of course which of the Sephiroth in the tree of life is the correct place to look for an entrance to a possible vault.
Yeah, let's talk more about that in a moment here. So, but just a little bit more on the menorah then there. Why is this important when it comes to building this temple if it is something that's constructed around the ideas of geometry, of uniting the heavens and the earth in that regard? I mean, is it a supernatural item with specific properties? I mean, I personally obviously see it as a symbolic items, not only, of course, with the seven lights being the known planets in the heavens at that time, including the sun and the moon. You know, you have that whole story on top of it, many other significant symbolic items as well. But how do you view the menorah, and why is it important in this equation here?
Well, the menorah is extremely important to anyone who is a Jew. And we find it as the coat of arms for Israel, for instance. And whether or not all seven candles are lit, I'm not sure, because I also heard that the seventh lamp is not lit, not until Messiah has arrived. So I'm not certain about this, but the temple is gone, and some people would like to build a new temple. And mm-hmm. if you have a new temple in Jerusalem, you would also need a new menorah. And the menorah that Titus stole is not the original menorah that was used in King Solomon's days. So they had to build several new menorahs because of theft, etc. But still, finding a menorah from Herod's temple would have a magical force, because it is what it is. And I fear the finding of such a menorah, because I think building a new temple in Jerusalem in these days is probably not the best of ideas.
Oh, that's funny. Yeah, we've talked about that many times on the program, and actually the desire by not only the Jews, of course, to build that at this location, but also the whole tradition with the Freemasonic connection to it as well. But if this is a Judaic tradition, why do you think this is so important to the Freemasons? What's the link here?
The Freemasons are talking about building a new temple. And I say that this new temple has already at least been constructed on the ground, but the edifice has not yet been built. So me being a Freemason myself, even if I'm not practicing, at least I have passed several degrees, so I have a certain initiation. My ambition is to safeguard this temple so that it's not being vandalized. So I'm not hoping to build an edifice on top of it. But I would love that politicians would step up and make sure that it is well taken care of. But the Masonic idea is to make a temple using your own self as a building stone for this this edifice. So it's a very symbolic, psychological, ethical image. But everything evolves around the building of a temple. And it's Solomon's temple that you hear about in the opening degrees of your Masonic life. But the menorah by itself is, I don't think that it has any magical powers. Something else with the ark though, because if we are going to take the Bible literally, which it's of course a question, should we do that? We hear that it had magical powers indeed, and it was extremely, it seems like it was high voltage, that you could get injured if you touched it, and it could hurt your enemies, and it even moved by itself. So I think that the ark is more interesting. If this is indeed the original ark that was found in Ethiopia, let's say that we accept the story that the Templars went to Ethiopia and they stole the ark that they were having, that this ark is indeed the same ark that we hear about in the Old Testament. Some people say that it could be meteoric stones inside. Some people say that it is a great capacitor. You could have high voltage coming out of it. So we don't know. So I think that this is a very interesting object. And we also know that on Oak Island there are very strong magnetic influences. They wreak havoc with fancy equipment. So we have had several occurrences of equipment that has always proven reliable, but bring it on to Oak Island, it just falls apart. So that made me speculate. Maybe it's the force of the ark that does this to it. And we see in our film that magnetic compasses, they show very wrong direction when you approach the swamp area. So north is almost south at some places there.
Ah, well, that's interesting in itself there. Now, let's talk a little bit more about basically asking you in terms of the relation of your finding, your location. You looked at the stone cross laid over the Kabbalah to that, found a different location from the money pit. And I wanted to ask you a little bit more about that, what that, if anything, has to do with your finding, because this is where the majority of effort over the years have gone into, all with the tunnels, all the things that have been found there with the timbers, you know, acting as barriers every, 10 feet or something like that. Coconut fibers have been found, sap, all kinds of things, the stone with the symbol on it. So what's the relationship between these sites?
Yeah, what is the relationship? What we know is that everything started with the money pit. So it has been very successful as something that draws people into the mystery. And my understanding of the money pit is that, one, it is not the proper place if you want to find a treasure, something that they should have thought of 200 years ago when they saw that it gets filled with water. So we have to look somewhere else. We should inspect this island. But instead, they just persist in trying to get to the bottom of that money pit, and they destroy everything, really. that it's just vandalism. So the monopit is worthless now. I think that that you won't find anything there. And I really hope that the treasure was not at the bottom of that monopit, below some of these floors that we read of, concrete floors, even metal floors that the drills were biting through. But I think that the function of the monopit also was that of being an earring shaft. I think that when you build something deep down, you need circulation of air. And I think the proper entrance is in the swamp, that you have not a channel, but like a mine going down from the swamp, maybe into the lower region of that Drumlin on the eastern part of the island. And this is where the monopit is.
Yep.
So you need the two openings. And when you close the door of the opening in the swamp, maybe you needed to do it first at the swamp and then the monopit. And then you built, of course, this water trap, and you had these platforms of oak that we hear of every 10 feet, etc. And maybe they were thinking that it shouldn't be possible to find just the monopit. But then again, we hear this story about this tree above the monopit, even with a block, with a rope dangling. I say, come here and find this wonderful, exciting spot. But I don't know how much faith we should put into these stories, actually.
Right.
And if my guys were the originators back in the 1620s, and why should a block be dangling from a tree almost 200 years later? I mean, it's just not credible. But I think that there is a connection, and it is a connection of ventilation, and it is also something that would generate interest, and at least we know that it has been generating interest. So it's not very speculative to land that assumption.
There's a lot of components to it. We have an underground drain system, as you said, water locks. It seems like there's a connection between various sites. It even is potentially that the swamp is something that's been created subsequently. One of my questions were, of course, how the heck did they even build this? If this was back in, well, you could clarify actually what date you think that they constructed all of this and put it together. But one of the other ideas, I don't want to ask, you know, put too much on you here, but one of the other ideas was considering the stone and the deciphered stone that they found as well, saying 40 feet below, 2 million pounds are buried. It was kind of, it would be kind of a, to sidetrack the issue, to put those who have a focus maybe only on the money aspect on the money pit, while what you found is something completely different. It's a way to kind of put the attention off on the main site, if you see what I'm getting at.
Oh yeah. But this inscribed stone, well, no one has seen it. We have these reports of it, and it was supposed to be part of the fireplace of one of the original discoverers of the monopit, and we know that it was supposedly used as a batting stone in a book bindery in Halifax. I don't put very much faith in that stone, actually.
Right. Yeah.
I don't. But still, we know that whatever they found, it created an interest. And those guys who were part of this adventure, they spent the rest of their lives chasing the treasure. So they must have experienced that there is something to this. So this is important, I think, but that text with 40 feet below, The cipher is too obvious.
Right. Yeah, it might be a fabrication, you're saying, from a later date.
Yes, to attract investors.
Yeah. Yeah. Interesting. Now, how do you think they built it then, though? I mean, the deep tunnel all the way down there, and the flood tunnel from Smith's Cove and all that is very pretty advanced stuff at that time, isn't it?
It is. I think that they used mine workers, if they were slaves or if they were convicts. But I think that they went to Spain and got their mercury and they got their workforce there. And then they had a workforce that didn't understand English, which of course is an advantage. I think that they may have done this in two stages. I think that the first stage could be to create the works, and the second stage to complete it by bringing over what should be stored there and sealing everything off. I think that the last part was completed in 1628, and I think the mastermind was Thomas Bushell. And he left England in two periods, first time for 3 years and the second for 2 years. And the second period was just after Francis Bacon, his master, had died. And I think that this is the date that I'm looking for, that nothing later than 1628.
Right.
And I think that it was a mining operation. And I think regarding the swamp, some people say that it is an artificial swamp. I think it is a natural swamp, but it could have been helped somewhat because you can see that there are signs of it being different from the rest of the shoreline of the island. Both sides, actually, both at Nolan's side, the northern side of the island, and also the southern. But I think it is just too much work to build a swamp like that, and you wouldn't know if it would work, because the point is that it should contain water, and this means that it must be filling itself with water. I don't know if it's enough with the rain. It may evaporate. So I think a working swamp that was there is something that made Oak Island ideal for the purpose. So you build some kind of coffer dam in the reverse, so to keep circular or square or whatever area dry by keeping the water out, and you perform your work, and when you are finished, you just release the water, and it is perfectly hidden. I think this is much easier than building a swamp from scratch. But who knows? Because if great mining operations were taking place on Oak Island, they also would need some place to put all the dirt that they had collected. So it could be something to that story that it was artificial, and we know that Dan Blankenship used a backhoe and dug in the part of the beach that holds the water inside the swamp, and he said that it's markedly different from other parts of the beach that he had been exploring. So who knows? It's just my mind that has difficulty with really believing that it is an artificial swamp, because it's huge and it must have been so much work. And I mean,
No, I get that. A couple of more questions here for you in terms of who owns. I mean, obviously we know that there's been a couple of people have died. There's a number of different companies and tons of people been involved, financially depleted. There's a number of things going on there. In terms of the quote unquote curse that is upon the island, is this again something that kind of attracts certain, you know, people as well, kind of the same way they have the curse of the, you know, the tombs in Egypt or something like that? Is that what that is? Or is there something to that, do you think?
Well, I think that it's just impossible not to think of a curse when six people dies trying to find the treasure. And seven is a wonderful number, so the curse is saying that seven people must die before the treasure is found. So, and I don't think that there was a curse until number six had died, and you had three dying at the same day. So I think that you will be able to track that that curse back to the 50s. But if this curse is something that attracts the modern day investors, I don't know. But at least it makes a great title for a TV show on History Channel.
Well, you were part of that too.
I was part of the History Channel TV series. I appear in episode 4 out of 5, and episode 5 is exploring my theories for even if I have left the island. And I didn't find anything specific when I was part of it, but I know that they did, because they got to explore the bottom of that swamp at the so-called Mercy Point. And if it was exactly the Mercy Point, or if it was more the Mercy area, because it's very difficult to find the exact point if we don't have this beacon-controlled GPS. So I don't know exactly where they did find this, but they did find coin minted sometime between 1550 and 1650 of Spanish origin. And at least if you dismiss ideas of it being planted, then someone must have had some business out into that swamp in the old days. And to me, this is indications that my Mercy Point idea, at least it's too early to say that it has been falsified. And we also know that the bottom conditions of the swamp was described as being flat, and if it is a normal beach, it would have rounded the stones on it. So they also used a metal detector, high-tech metal detector, and discovered something that gave readings of non-ferrous metal down into the swamp. But and this is more than just that coin, but we don't know what else could be buried there. And maybe they will find something this summer, so we will know something more.
Yeah, exactly. It's very interesting. Now, can you just briefly tell us a little bit more about what you think might be found? An entrance you mentioned before. Entrance to what exactly? The temple or what?
If they choose, and I mean they, and I hope that that will be the owners teaming up with qualified archaeologists. If they choose to find what is hiding, or if there is something hiding on the bottom of that swamp, my speculation is that they will find an entrance to some tunnel leading down into a vault, possibly also going in a U shape down and then in and then up again, so that the vault will be in the Drumlin, the eastern part of the island, and it will be above the water level of the swamp, and of course also the ocean. This is what I expect to be there if my theory is correct. But it could also be a vault directly below the Mercy Point, but that would be very risky, and will also be less in line with the great constructions that we see signs of elsewhere, with water channeling from the beach just to make a trap, etc. So why would they choose that simple an approach for the ultimate more that. I think that there is more to it. I think that you need to follow this this tunnel down in the ground. So I'd say that the chances of really discovering the treasure are quite slim, and I would prefer that they keep the mystery. And that means that my theory will never be proven right, but I think that the mystery is a treasure by itself, and it's something that Nova Scotia could use in order to promote their area as an interesting part for tourists. If they find the treasure, then it's interesting for a few years, and then who cares? So I hope really that they will not really go for it, but that they would study the history instead, look at the clues that I bring to the table, look at what's in the area, look at other people's clues, and maybe they could piece together a beautiful theory that will attract interest from the whole world in a totally new scale.
Tell us more about the financing of the project and how people can support you financially and where they can get the DVD as well.
My current position in this telling of what's on Oak Island has been challenged because I was asked to participate in a new season of the History Channel show, but because I have been promoting political ideas that will make it mandatory to have an archaeologist on board. It's a political bill that was presented some weeks ago, and this will make it more costly for those who explore and also for those who wish to make television. And that made them say that, Peter, we don't want to work with you again.
Jeez.
And we have our own show that we are putting together. We have the Norwegian Productions, of course, but we are selling shares in what will be the ultimate TV series about Oak Island as regards this Shakespeare, Rosicross, Freemasonic theory. And what we try to piece together is a 4-episode series of 45 minutes each. And also a film that is meant to be distributed to select theaters, but also for streaming. And we are selling shares worth of 120,000 euros. And so far, we have sold more than 35% of the shares, but we are inviting people all over the world to join in here. One share costs 49 euros, and you get lots of interesting stuff in return. You get streaming of all our films, the original 4-episode Norwegian TV series, for the first time subtitled in English. You get the Shakespeare, The Hidden Truth film, the original one in English, and you get also part 2, which was filmed last summer and completed this year in March, and which is in English, and you get my ebook, you get the original Norwegian book with lots of interesting illustrations, and the most important thing is that we are releasing footage that has never before been shown, and we do this in order to get help from our investors so that they can tell us which of these video clippings should be included in the new production. So we have these wonderful discussions going on Facebook, and I can only hope that people will join the discussion by coming investors and go to the newjelly.com, www.newjelly.com, and look up Shakespeare and you'll find it. And you can even stream the 2 first episodes of the TV series without investing. And these are in Norwegian, but they are subtitled in English, and lots of the spoken dialogue is in English anyway. So it's something that I suggest everybody would do who are interested in Okan.
Okay, as a last measure to kind of wrap things up, obviously we have Shakespeare, thehiddentruth.com. Please also give us the Facebook page if you want to give that out. And if there's anything else you'd like to leave us with before we wrap things up for this time, Petter, it's been really great having you here. Thank you for your time. Really exciting stuff and interesting findings, of course. So whatever you'd like to leave us with, please go ahead.
Yes, I would invite everybody to go to www.newjelly, that is newjelly.com, newjelly.com, and look up our project. There you'll find two episodes that you can stream free of charge. And if you read the material and you find that you would support our project, you will get all kinds of interesting things. Not as a thank you, but we would like to educate you so that you can participate in creating this ultimate version of our TV series. So that is the step that I would encourage everybody to take, actually. And from there are endless possibilities.
We will have that page linked up as well, newjelly.com. It's /equity/Shakespeare. That's where you can see more about this project. All right, well, keep up the good work, Petter. Thank you so much for coming on, and maybe we can have you back in the future and see where the story goes, okay?
Thank you so much for having me. It's been an honor.
And we'll continue to talk more about the Judaic legacy and the Yahweh myth on Friday, with Sharia S, a.k.a. DM Murdoch, who joins us for a very interesting program, Did Moses Really Exist? And we discuss in further detail the Abrahamic legacy of monoculture and how the cultural genocide that Europe and the West is committing right now is destroying diversity. Not to be missed. Very important, very informative. Before this, however, on Wednesday, don't miss Craig Fitzgerald on Radio 314 on nationalist anarchism. Very good show. We also have Michael Hoffman II, Paul Craig Roberts, Gregory Sams, Paul Ramsey, and many more coming up. All right, guys and gals, thank you for being with us today, and thank you for being a member as well. We appreciate your interest and support. We'll talk to you in just a few days. Please take care of yourself and your family and friends, and we'll see you soon.